Time for a few questions for Steve and for Ted. Anybody have any questions? Rosalie?
First of all, I'd like to echo what you're saying about the difficulty of getting companies that receive the government awards to acknowledge that in their government interest page. I just finished a study using citation analysis for our Department of Energy project, and luckily they had a database where they were also collecting from the companies the patents that had some funding from DOE, but unfortunately it was very tough to know how many of those didn't. You know, those that were in the record usually didn't cite government interest in their patents, so it was hard to know how many you were missing that might have not been reported initially as having the government funding, and then they don't report government interest on, especially when the money comes through a consortium or sort of a second party, you know, sort of routed that way. So I commend you for your efforts along those lines, but my question is, do you have any insight, having gone through this also, for how an organization such as ATP or other, or DOE or other agencies who would like to use citation analysis downstream using patent data could encourage companies to be more forthcoming in terms of providing the patent information and doing and recording appropriately government interests when it's maybe not in their interest to do so?
Go to the microphone. Okay, up there.
You know, I guess the only thing that I can say is that if you've got the ability to do follow-up phone calls, if you've got – one of the things that worked out nicely for us was that when we found searches that had not been reported, we were able to put it up on the website so that the next time they went in to complete the survey, they saw those patents that they had not given us before. So they sort of knew that we were, in fact, really serious about trying to get as much of the patent information as we could. It would have, you know, in some cases, if you can, it would be nice to do the follow-up and say, let's do some calls and say, have you really given us all the patent information that really relates to this project? I suspect that we would have gotten more if we'd been able to do that.
Rosalie, one concern we have in the new program moving forward is that in order to ease burden, TIP awardees are going to report patents and publications through iEdison. So it's kind of one-stop shopping where they don't have to report all over the place. Now, one concern there is once you had them on the hook or on the website going through a survey, just get the information then, because now what's going to happen is they're going to have to say, fill out some other survey items of interest to the program. Now, don't forget to go to this other place and do some more entry. And it remains to be seen, but, you know, one concern is they're just going to skip that part. So kind of what we're hoping to do is on our end just to say we can't ask them anymore. It's in the terms and conditions. We can't make them report it to us. So we can just say, how many did you have? Right? Three. Thank you. Remember, you have to go over here to report those three, and then just keep getting that data back and forth, and when we don't see three showing up, we just start pestering them until hopefully we see three show up over there. But it's a real concern.
Other question?
Yes, Jim. It was interesting to note that with their original information, you were getting less than 800 patents reported, and with this other technique, you're getting double that amount. So now that you have an indicator of success of a sort through the patent process. But there are also companies that are not patenting it intentionally because it's intellectual property, and if they patent it, this intellectual property will be released to everybody, all the competitors and whatever. Is there any way of evaluating to include those that are keeping their intellectual property secret to themselves without jeopardizing this property of theirs, so that the patent thing, you know, it seems like a valid indicator of success, but it's not sufficient when you include this intellectual property withholding.
I have a comment on that. We'll be talking about this after lunch, but I've done a lot of sleuthing on exactly that, writing the story of a project. And so what I do is I search, when I have the project documents, I find any names of technical people, and I search on those names in the patent office in order to find those hidden patents. I also search on the assignee name and key technology terms, and so I try to find a list, and then I go to the company representative and I say, hey, I also found these other patents. Can you tell me if they're from this project? So I probably double on average the number of patents. And in addition, then we also count project or commercial products. So we give them some credit for a commercial product, even if they have no publications and no patents. And we call that knowledge creation because it is exactly what you're saying. It's hidden IP.
We also did, and then we'll just drop it, there was earlier efforts made to count invention disclosures. So within internal mechanisms in a company, it tended to be larger companies that would have some formal process. So even if it didn't go to a USPTO, if their own internal, for IP protection, call it, you know, they would have their own invention disclosure process. But the concern there was we were having a difficult time mapping this invention disclosure turned into this patent application, which turned into this. And so it wasn't as clear to us that on the reporting requirement, how open the other government agencies or OMB would be to, okay, we'll count invention disclosure as something in here. But we did make some effort to get a sense of, and there were more of that to be sure, where they're saying, we're willing to tell you we've had three invention disclosures within our company, but they're just never going to be patented.
Other questions?
Okay. Question from the phone?
Go ahead. And Peter, before you begin, let me just say for others on the phone, if you refresh your wiki page, I've changed the link to the chat room. So the chat room is now working. Apologies for that. And you can put questions there and raise your hand. Go ahead, Peter.
Okay. Question for Stephen. I noticed on your sort of horizon, going back on the longer term impact, it sort of didn't go over 10 years. And obviously the program has only been around for 18 years, but it's well known in major technologies like the internet or even something like the mouse or graphic user interface. I mean, these things took about like 25 years from the time when it first showed up in the lab to the time it's sort of fully commercialized and making huge impacts. How do you sort of recognize that discrepancy in terms of your evaluation horizon?
Yeah, you're exactly right, and which is why we tried to anchor the question on how many years till you first saw any revenue impact. We have always struggled with, even if you do this in the post-project survey, of, you know, call that first impact the bottom part of that S-curve of technology adoption, and the question is, how do we anchor in a consistent way what the top part of that S-curve is? Is it, you know, market saturation? Is it break-even? Is it? So we're having a difficult time saying where. It's easier to say we can all recognize when you made your first dollar, but it's harder to say when is impact big enough to try to get something with that. So we always did struggle with that. We had some questions in all our surveys trying to say, you know, what. And this is just hard to do, so you can take the values of what they're worth, but, you know, what do you think the value to downstream users or ultimate consumers is going to be 2 years, 5 years, and 10 years from now? Now, the question is, if they tell us, you know, $18 billion 10 years from now, how much value can we put in that answer?
Steve, we have one more question.
Yeah. So the question to Steve, I guess, was triggered by Ted's slide and his use of the term firmographic stuff. It's about the relationship, I guess, between the selection process, criteria, I guess, and project success. It was an assessment of an awardee, a potential awardee's ability to perform, given a large sum of money coming in. Was that part of the selection process at all or not?
Yeah, I think it is, and there's enough here where I could be shouted down if I don't say it correctly. But, yeah, certainly there was a specific criteria under ATP that addressed the pathway to commercialization, which is some reflection of their ability to make sure the research results ultimately get implemented. And that depends on their own capabilities as well as their ability to collaborate and use alliances to move that technology forward. So it is.
But is that in some cases maybe an intervening variable? If you're not very good at assessing a company's ability to perform, that may be an issue as well. I mean, how you do that, that's a difficult thing to do, is it not true?
It is, and they have to write detailed explanations and come before evaluation panels in person and make that case.
So selection in the selection criteria, one of the key components of their technical, we have 50% of the selection criteria is the technical, our technical criteria, and of that, the quality of the R&D plan is a key component. So what are the capability, what are the competencies of the researchers performing the tasks? And that is assessed by the NIST review panel, which includes NIST scientists. So there's a thorough technical assessment of the team's ability to carry out the proposed R&D tasks.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted and Steve. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, now we'll go to the next group. And what I've just thank you very much. Great session. I just in light of that last question, I just put up a slide from our one of the presenters from February 19 workshop, and this is work that is actually being done by the ACM. The title was Keeping Good Ideas in the Air, but you can see that the green is the PhD thesis, you know, early 80s, leading to things that we're familiar with now, web services, middleware, and so on. But the concept is the intertwining of the researchers and those companies moving towards productization. And if you're interested in this type of mapping in charting of impacts over time, this is a cover story in March IEEE.